Welcome to The Legends Among Us, a podcast devoted to the troopers and veterans of 3rd Cavalry Regiment. We have with us a few members from our Regimental Fires team, as well as our S3 from Steel Squadron, which is our Regimental Field Artillery Squadron. So with us today is Sergeant First Class Chris. Do you go by Chris or Christopher?
No, Chris is fine.
Sergeant First Class Chris McCoy, Sergeant First Class Anthony Bauma, and Major Clayton Ivy. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having us. Yep,
Absolutely. So we'll just kind of get right after it. I have a deep affection for Steel Squadron. I think it's just because of the time that you, Major Ivy, and I had in Korea, because I think you were the first one that I met. And at the time, you were the fire support officer for the regiment. So now you've moved over to Steel. I kind of developed this affection, this affinity for Steel, even though you weren't there yet, just because of some things that had happened and just because of the climate that existed there and hanging out with you guys. We've got you guys all here. If you could, just for the listening audience, give us a little bit of background, how you ended up in the Army. How did you end up perhaps at 3CR? Because that's always a question I like to ask.
All right. My name is Sergeant First Class McCoy. A little bit of background about myself. I'm originally from North Carolina. I'm a country boy at heart. Went to college at Fayetteville State University. And then I became a police officer as I studied English literature and criminal justice. Criminal justice took my fancy. I found it more interesting than reading and writing books and essays. But then I went into the law enforcement field. I enjoyed that. Did that for 5 years. Got married. Had children. And my wife, who's also prior service, she was in the Air Force. She got a job when she transitioned out of the Air Force, working over at the Pentagon. So I moved with my wife and children up there to the D.C. area. This was during the recession time, and there was just no decent work at the time. So being a husband, a father, I was a little bit too proud to sit at home and take the girls to school and braid hair and cook dinner. So I decided, hey, one day I'm going to go to the recruiter's office. I heard the Army's always hiring. So I went to the recruiter's office. They took me to MEPS. I did my ASVAB and scored through the roof. Went to MEPS, and they gave me a list of jobs that were available, and the career counselor showed me some videos. I saw the video that looked most like a Rambo or Predator movie. That's the one that took my eye. And figured if I want to be in the Army, I want to do something cool like in the videos that I saw. And it also had the biggest bonus at the time, which is a great incentive. So at the time, I decided to become a 13 Fox, a fire support specialist, now a joint fire support specialist. And from there on, shipped out to basic training at Fort Knox, Kentucky, AIT at Fort Sill, and reported my first duty station over at Schofield Barracks, Hawaii. From there, I've PCS to Fort Hood, then to Fort Wainwright, Alaska, to Fort Sill, where I became an AOC instructor at the NCO Academy, and right back here to Fort Hood again, my second go-around as part of the 3rd Cavalry Regiment.
Okay, so you've been here twice. When were you here last?
I got here in January of 2014 and transitioned to Alaska, got orders, PCS orders. It was the summer of 2016.
Okay.
So about 2.5 years I was here.
Got it. Major Ivy, what's your path?
So Major Clayton Ivy, born and raised Texan, so didn't have to go far to get here. Went to college. During college, we went to the summer camp that back then was called LDAC, now Cadet Summer Training. And they bring out all the branches and they do big demonstrations. And like Sergeant McCoy said, they have hype videos. At the time, GWAT was still very much so in the height because this would have been, 2010. And I thought, if I'm going to do something in the Army, I want it to be mass casualty producing. Between seeing 777s and Paladins and the videos of what forward observers do, that really called to me. So I wanted artillery from the time I was a junior in college, ended up getting it, going to Fort Sill for my Bullock. From there, I did my first 6 years at Bragg, bouncing around into units there. And then I went to Sill and came to Fort Hood to be part of 3rd SFAB initially. Got to do some deployments and employments with them, and then went to division staff. While I was on division staff, they look at the KD slate for majors, and they said, hey, here are the units that'll have openings. And I knew that I wanted to stay as light as possible. It was what I knew, what I understood, and what I enjoyed. There's only one regiment on this base of the four brigade size elements that stay on the light side. So I was drawn to 3CR, and I got lucky enough to come here where, for the first year, like you said, I was the regimental fire support officer and had a phenomenal team. You know, previously Sergeant Boma was one of the squadron fire support element NCOICs, and Sergeant McCoy was my right-hand man when I was as the regimental fire support officer. So continued to love it. And as you said, I've now transitioned to the operations officer for the regimental field artillery squadron. And that's how I got here.
Sergeant Boma, how'd you
end up here? My story is drastically different from theirs.
Okay.
I joined at 18, straight out of high school, as a very naive kid, you know, from the middle of nowhere in Missouri, just north of Springfield, and just wanted to get out of the hometown. So went, signed my first contract December of 2010, shipped out to be a EOD tech, actually, in May of 2011. Went through, ended up failing out of EOD, obviously. That's how I'm a joint fire supporter now. Like I said, naive kid, didn't know exactly what I was getting into, did zero homework prior to leaving. Just, hey, that job looks cool. It gets me out of here quick. It has a big bonus. Let's go. So got reclassed, made it through the fire support AIT at the time, got sent through the Bradley Fighting Vehicle course, came my first time to Fort Hood. So got here my first time in 2012, did a couple years here, went to Riley for a couple years, came back to Fort Hood again. Got my light stint, got to spend my time over in Hawaii too and had some fun out there. And that's actually what changed my mind to go in-def and stay in the Army and make it a full-fledged career. So went in-def out there and really enjoyed working in the brigade element and learning more of the running the fifth certification side and just seeing how much more fulfilling of a job it is, like being at the brigade echelon. So came here, had to do my squadron platoon sergeant time. Third time back at Fort Hood, so yeah, I took over Sabre, did my platoon sergeant time, and just laterally transferred upon the completion of my golf school to take Sergeant McCoy's position as the regiment of fire support of my golf.
Okay, I was going to just get some clarification on that. Yep. So you are the outgoing
I am the outgoing regiment fire support NCO, and Sergeant First Class Bauma is getting ready to be my replacement.
I'm just going to dive right in. So you all know we had an RSTRUC that came out a year and a half ago. And one of the requirements of the RSTRUC was that all of the field artillery units were going to consolidate under Divardi. And so we didn't. And I've never like explored the reasons why. I've never talked to like Colonel Fatula as to why that has happened. But from your perspective, how did we avoid falling under 1st Cav's Divardi?
So I'll jump on this first because I was on division staff when that guidance came out and was part of the working groups that were looking at how it was going to affect the brigades on, at the time, Fort Cavazos specifically. I was on division staff at the time, so I was involved in some of the OPTs that were looking at how RSTRUC was going to affect the installation of Fort Cavazos as a whole. How I believe it happened that 3rd Cavalry Regiment Regimental Field Artillery Squadron did not fall under 1st Cav is due to the unique weapon systems in 3rd Cavalry Regiment versus the three brigade combat teams. We are 777s versus paladins, and adding the logistical burden to the brigade headquarters that is 1st Cav Divardi would complicate the sustainment of a completely different battalion size element of different vehicles and different weapon systems than the 3rd Brigade combat teams down the street. I do remember us reading, it was pretty direct, saying, you know, all brigade combat teams artillery will fall under divisional artillery. I left around the time the official decision was being made, so I'm not sure how exactly the decision for us to not fall under 1st Cav Divardi occurred. But if I had to make a guess, it would pertain to the headquarters size of Divardi and having to manage sustainment for different types of weapon systems across the installation. We are TRA to 1st Cav Divardi, so they are our treading readiness authority. So they do oversee our table progressions and approve of us meeting the gates required to do our mission. But we do not fall in under them organically. We are still DS to 3rd Cavalry Regiment.
Gentlemen, any other additional thoughts or insights on that? Does that sound
That sounds about right to me. I just do what I'm told around here. So I had the major.
Yes.
Those guys make the decisions and us NCOs execute.
Execute. Okay. But you got to trust the field grades.
Absolutely. And I do trust Major Ivy.
You obviously got replaced by Major Garcia. You're missed. And Major Garcia is doing a great job. I imagine it's been good for you to go to Steele and to get some reps over there. You spent some time in Sabre, Sergeant Bauma. What was that culture like, being field artillery in an infantry squadron?
So it's very different.
Right.
They don't really know how to handle us. They don't really know day to day what we have going on. And then especially I showed up midway through the career rotation. So I showed up. They were prepping for the next fist cert, prepping for artillery table 12s, 15s, CalFexes, all that. So it was a very combined effort that I tried to keep them in the loop, but they just don't understand some of the lingo just because it's drastically different worlds. So it was more so that at the squadron level, it's very reliant on just the captain, my counterpart at the squadron level, the FSO, and the platoon sergeant, the sergeant first class or staff sergeant filling in, on just to, you know, do the right thing and report to them, and we support them exactly when we need to. And when we tell them, hey, we have field time with Steele, we have to be here at this time and we need to find a way out there, like they're extremely supportive. So with Sabre, I lucked out and they were extremely supportive staff. And if we needed a POV at the time or a GOV out in Korea, they would let us know, or they would make one for us, and we would get pretty much anywhere we needed to be.
It's interesting that you mentioned that they are accommodating, because I imagine you're not the only Fires NCO that exists that's embedded within like an infantry squadron here in 3CR. Is that correct?
Yeah. So each squadron has the same team essentially.
So did they have the same degree of flexibility to get out to conduct?
That's where it heavily depends on the squadron command team and how well they understand the fires fight and how much they essentially support the fires fight. If you have a squadron command team that really backs you up and is willing to support you, it makes a drastic difference on just if they understand how to utilize fires. And that's kind of our selling point also. That's our second job while we're over there, is we have to sell the fires fight to them if they don't understand it. It's our job to get them at a squadron level to understand how to use us and everything that we bring to the battlefield to help them on the maneuver side.
Well, and this is a question that I have for all of you. So how do you justify integrating fires in these units that are largely based upon movement and maneuver?
Hey, I'll speak on that. I've always been one for, like Sergeant Bauma was mentioning, selling what we bring to that maneuver commander. And it's us, it's our job as fire supporters to be able to articulate to that commander, hey, help us save you from the fight that you don't have to fight. You're doing your movement and maneuver. You have objectives to seize and key terrain to seize. If you utilize us and let us do what we do best, again, we're going to go out there. We're going to observe the enemy. We're going to control surface-to-surface fires, air-to-surface from fixed wing, rotary wing. We're going to integrate and deconflict those different assets to mass fires on objectives, mass fires on the enemies, and save you from the fight. And your maneuver, your platoon leaders, and your company commanders save you from the fight that you don't have to fight. So by the time you walk on that objective, you're mopping up scraps. That is our job, to come up with that plan, that fire support plan, integrate all those different assets that I just mentioned, and mass fires on the enemy. Hey, we have the most mass casualty producing weapon systems in the regiment. Right. So let us utilize those systems to meet your intent while saving you from contact that you don't have to take, because we've taken care of it for you before you ever stepped out.
Do you all feel like at every echelon of leadership you have gotten what you've needed with regards to resources and training time?
As both NCOs have said, it is incredibly dependent on the command team at the echelon that you work with. Fortunately, you know, the 80th and the 81st from all interactions so far are incredibly supportive and understanding that intel and fires drive the pace of the battle, right? Like, those are your two important things to shape the battle, because we don't want to go into a fair fight.
Right.
Like, if we go into a fair fight, then we as fire supporters have not done our job. And something that I have found a good trick for any young fire supporter, either officer or enlisted, that's trying to get what they need from a command team, is there's like two big things you can explain to a maneuver commander. It's make sure that you demonstrate an understanding of their plan before you start talking about your plan. And then explain how you're there to take one thing off that commander's plate at whatever echelon it is. This translates down to even a PL. If you're there and you can explain, hey, sir or ma'am, I've got this aspect of the battle covered, I have found great success with getting what I need on the backside of that. So we're all in, as they discussed, like when it comes time to support that maneuver training, we're all in, we're committed, we're embedded with your team, we're there with you sharing in the suck. There's a backside of that after we're probably going to change some team members out and we're going to have to go through our table progression, just like every other maneuver branch has their table progression, whether it be mounted gunnery, dismounted mortars, things like that. So when we demonstrate an understanding of their plan, we're going to synchronize and integrate so that we can support that plan. I have generally had success with the reciprocal relationship of then we're provided the time and space to do what we need to do to continue to support those maneuver commanders.
What I've observed about this organization, and this is probably true for many different brigades, but this is just my myopic view being this is my first time serving in a brigade, is that we're very much about trying to unburden other levels of leadership within the organization. When you talk to like the 80th or the 81st, even for that matter, I think said something very similar, that the regimental staff exist in their minds to unburden, if you will, all the way down to the troop command level. That manifests itself in different forms in terms of how we, as operating out of our warfighting functions, unburden lower leaders so that they can conduct training, so that they can become certified in certain weapon systems, so they can have better OR rates when it comes to meeting division requirements. You've kind of explained how you would do that. What kind of stress might that produce as a result of trying to free up the squadrons or free up commanders?
I'm thinking of an example that comes to mind, supporting our maneuver, our subordinate units, our adjacent units to our left and our right. Sergeant Bauman and myself were just sitting down prior to walking over here trying to figure out fist certification. So in order for the artillery to fire their live fires, us as observers, as fire supporters, have to be certified to observe a fire. Same thing with mortars. When the mortars go out and certify on their weapon systems. And oftentimes we get stuck in a place to where we have to get our certifications done while supporting artillery tables and mortips. And then there's still, you know, platoon sticks and company Calfex. And oftentimes we get pulled in multiple directions at the same time while trying to meet our mission, meet our intent to be certified, qualified ourselves, qualifying our JFOs, our joint fires observers that have to, you know, integrate fires with aircraft and moving aircraft through airspace while there's rounds flying through the airspace at the same time. So it gets very difficult to meet our intent, to meet our mission, our certification, our different requirements that we have to meet every 6 months while also supporting maneuver, supporting Steel Squadron, and the mission of the regiment at the same time. We make it happen. It's not always pretty, but at the end of the day, we figure it out, and we make sure everybody's end goal is met at the end of the day.
So I know that specific piece about the stress it induces is, you know, Sir McCoy alluded to it. We have to stay ahead at different levels of everything in the artillery, and it does induce some stress to the system, because there are still the ALCs, BLCs, MLCs that are big army requirements of each individual member of your team. There's the PME aspect, like Master Gunner. You have to send people to the Master Gunner course in order to do the job that Sergeant McCoy filled and Sergeant Bauman is now filling. So to stay ahead of maneuver, we as artillery have to plan before their plan is finalized. In order for the artillery squadron to be able to do its mission ahead of the maneuver, the fire supporters have to go ahead of us. So as far as the stress goes, is you see a training calendar that goes out to T plus 12 and it looks relatively available. Well, once you start plugging in all of those individual requirements that the entire fire support enterprise requires to support the maneuver plan that's coming in, that window now gets very saturated very quickly, because in addition to that, we're, as Sergeant McCoy said, supporting the MORTEPs, and those are sprinkled in the few white spaces you have. So the planning down to the troop level for us kind of doesn't change regardless of the echelon you're at, but it is always stress inducing to the system when you're also trying to get your individuals to the schools they need and better their careers and also get your mission accomplished ahead of being able to support the other missions that need to be accomplished that require your support.
Does your job as field artilleryman create a unique type of stress that perhaps doesn't exist in other corners of 3CR?
So that's actually what I was about to bring up. Yes, we have essentially double the amount of stress as every other, you know, military job, because yes, we have to go out when the maneuver is going out. You know, we have to go do the live fire, the squad, platoon, company live fires that they're all doing. But then simultaneously, as I said, we have to come out of that and a week later go out and support artillery tables, you know, which go all the way through 15, 18, sometimes if they have training available and space available to do it. Essentially, we're in the field twice as much as everybody else. So on the backside of that, I think we can all attest to it, especially I have four kids. So it's very hard on the family life. And then growing up through the ranks, you know, you're like, oh, well, when I get the next one, I'll have more time off. I'll have more time down. I'll do this. And there is no break. So you just have to, have a strong partner on the other side of you, and you just got to, you know, enjoy and make the best moments that you have when you do have the white space and you do have the weekends home, because the family stress is enormous.
As far as your question of like the stress, I would say it's not unique to the private through specialist sergeant. It is shared. What's amazing to see, and it's not unique to this organization, but, you know, love the one you're with, and currently we share the load. Like, you're not going to see FISR going on where the NCOs aren't out there, and so that stress that specialist is feeling, more than likely staff sergeants and sergeants first class are feeling as well. And, you know, there's this old joke of like, where are the FISTers? Oh, they're doing FISCert. And you know, it's kind of a joke, but it's also a reality. You know, when you've got three maneuver squadrons with three teams each and then a squadron FSE, that's a lot of people that you have to keep up on certification, and the odds that all of them are available at the same time is slim to none. So when we start looking at planning this training, a deliberate effort of mine as the current three is to at least consolidate it. And I know it does violate our current P-week methodology, but it's in the interest of predictability, because I can't buy people time, because we only have so much time to accomplish things, but I can do everything in my power to buy them predictability. And I'm very fortunate that I have a very supportive command team at Steel Squadron, and they're all about it. So instead of doing, you know, a week in the field with a 2-day break, a week in the field with a 2-day break, we're kind of condensing it in order to buy the batteries, that white space on the lead side, to get predictability to those troopers and try and get them into those schools. And then they can see on the calendar 3 months out, like, hey, here's our tables window. You know, I can't tell you yet what battery is going what day, but just anticipate for these 2 weeks, start telling your family, to Sergeant Bama's point, because that's a big thing for me, is like families and predictability of the family. Start telling them, hey, these 2 weeks are going to be rough, but between now and then, the times aren't going to be as rough. So there's definite stress induced at echelon for both soldiers and leaders, but we do our best trying to get them the lead time to help them understand. And there's, you know, nuts you just can't crack. LTP is over Halloween. You know, things like that are gonna happen, but we know that now. And so it's like, hopefully you're maximizing the time and the special things when you're gonna have to miss those salient holidays to try and, you know, put some love in the love bank, for lack of a better expression.
Sure.
And Sergeant Bauman nailed it. Like, hopefully you're with a spouse who's supportive, because if not, it just adds that stress when you do get home then. And that's what I know a lot of people do struggle with, is you're stressed at work, then you get home and the family life adds stress.
Totally different question, because I've never really been in this type of environment. I imagine you all have not either, because of just simply because of the generation of warfighters that you all are. But how would we deploy fires to a combat zone against a near peer threat when we collaborate as chaplains. We talk about what ministry would look like in a near peer threat where we're looking at casualties upwards of 500 or more in a very short amount of time. And that shapes how we fulfill our core competencies as chaplains. I imagine there's got to be some shifts just in terms of thinking, shifts in planning paradigms when it comes to how you would employ fires in that type of environment as well. Have you all projected what that might look like?
Yeah, we've had this conversation before, especially with the new RStruck that's come out. The regiment is just going to be organized differently than what it has been in the past. And with that, you know, we've had the talk about putting the forward back in forward observer and having our FOs, our 13 Foxes, forward of their maneuver and utilizing their tools, their assets, their LODRs and whatnot to actually be forward and be the eyes of the regiment, since many of the assets that we traditionally had, such as some of our ISR shadows and Gray Eagles, things along that line, that no longer going to be available organically to the organization. So now putting those young FOs out in front of their infantry squadrons, out in front of their maneuver to do what they do best, you know, locate the enemy, work fire missions, and get fires on those enemies prior to their maneuver moving up forward. Same thing with the Steel Squadron. They're going to have to be mobile. You know, we see the news. We see the conflicts going on. And with the advent of drones and the massing of drones, a towed artillery system is going to be very easy to locate and either bring fires or just have that drone drop a grenade or a mortar round of some sort on top of them. They're going to have to be mobile, be able to shoot and move and communicate quickly and while still delivering fires, you know, accurately and effectively on the enemy. So we're going to have to evolve the way we fight, the way we move, the way we communicate, how we observe, you know, how we send fire missions back and forth from the front line all the way back to the regiment element and down to the gun lines. And it's going to be, you know, a process to figure out exactly how do we do this, how do we do it effectively, and how can we improve upon it as we continue, you know, our different training cycles.
So you all know personally who you would push. Like, let's just say tomorrow we go to war with Russia or China. You all know who you would push into those forward observer positions specifically by name, probably.
I can think of probably about five off the top of my head right now. Mm-hmm.
Do you think they're ready for that? Because the reason I ask is because I can think of like probably 20 chaplains who would be in a mass casualty producing situation. And maybe half of them would be able to withstand the emotional turmoil of having to constantly provide casualty care in the midst of just gross amounts of death and destruction. The other half would be able to do it well. One half would be able to do it well. The other half would probably come out of that experience just shattered as individuals. So I'm kind of curious to know if you all have similar thoughts about the individuals that you would potentially put in those types of positions, because I think overall across the Army formation, we don't know what percentage of soldiers actually will be prepared for a mass cal type scenario, but you all know, at least at your level, who would be and perhaps who wouldn't be. Thoughts?
Absolutely. I love this question. Sergeant Bauma and I came up in a different generation. We've got a different generation of young troopers now. Some are chomping at the bit to go out there and do their job. They would make excellent observers. They're physically and mentally fit to go do the job and the stresses that come along with it. And then we have a generation of troops that they may not be. Well, you know, I'm just going to say like it is, that are not physically or mentally fit enough, in my personal opinion, to handle the stressors and the rigors, both mentally and physically, of humping, you know, a rucksack full of LODRs and tripod legs and binos and maps and map markers and your J-Fire and extra batteries for your radio and extra antennas and hand mics, because something inevitably is going to break when you need it the most. So you got to have spares. And quickly, that rucksack turns from 45 pounds to double that weight. And, you know, and the frame is literally hanging on by the seams because it's getting ready to crack. And then, you know, hey, you need to move up there with weapons squad, or the mortar firing point needs more 60s, FOs. Guess what? Dump your bag and tote a bag full of 60-millimeter mortar rounds to the mortar firing point because the mortars need more rounds. Yeah. We've done that before, and we've got to be flexible to, again, like we've mentioned many times before, to meet that commander's intent, to help our maneuver, support our maneuver, while still getting those fires down. And I've done it. I've dumped my bag and my equipment on the ground filled it full of mortar rounds and ran to a mortar firing point to drop more rounds to my mortars who are supporting the fire missions that I'm calling. Yeah, we see a lot of young troops that crack under pressure. And, you know, it's our job as NCOs to prepare them, you know, physically and mentally for some of the rigors and the stresses that they will inevitably endure doing their job. But it's not quite the same anymore. Sergeant Bauma, I've been in for 15 years now, and we've seen the Army evolve and change. And some are ready and some are not.
Yeah, I'm optimistic. I'd like to believe that regardless of whatever generations follow us, whatever successive generations come into the Army long after we're gone, that there will still be a percentage, preferably a higher percentage of people who are prepared for the rigors of war versus those who are not. And I've always, maybe you guys have heard this analogy as well, or not necessarily an analogy, but this comparison of sometimes you'll see that garrison all-star like crumble under the pressure of going to combat, whereas the garrison weakling will rise to the occasion when combat creates stress in his or her life that they've never experienced before. So I suppose it's yet to be seen who would really do well in that type of environment. But I'm just thinking carrying rounds alone and running, like you had mentioned, Sergeant McCoy being able to shoot, move, and communicate, but under fire and rapidly is going to just break some people off in ways that we can't even comprehend right now.
Yeah, it will break you off, that's for sure.
I just want to say it's not like y'all are that much older than me, right? I'm over 14 years myself, so a couple months difference.
I just hit 14 years.
Yeah, so.
Do you feel like they were singling you out in that?
They did. It came up in different generations.
McCoy is, I'm feeling the age now. I got a late start to the Army. I enlisted, I was 27 years old when I shipped out to basic training. Yeah. I had already been a police officer for 5 years prior to that. And it'll beat you up. But you got to take care of yourself. You got to take care of your body.
You do.
And like we mentioned, though, that preparedness, being physically and mentally fit, you know, we have to stay sharp ourselves. So that we can help our troops stay sharp, both physically and mentally. You know, the work, being a fire supporter, it is physically demanding. It will beat you up. And if you don't take care of yourself, take care of your body, stay in shape, stay fit, and stay mentally fit. Like we mentioned before, you know, having that support system, whether you're married, whether you're single, having friends, family, somebody you can talk to where you can decompress, you can unwind. Sometimes I just go home and I just vent and just let it out. And my wife just, you know, just close her mouth and listens and let me let it out. Yeah. And then when I'm done, she's like, okay, now you feel better? I say, as a matter of fact, I do feel better. You know, what's for dinner? That plays a big role. It really does.
How has working on cars helped you process your frustration, or is that part of the process? Like, I just had to throw that in there.
I'm Sergeant McCoy is the car guy around still. I've put on the last two car shows for the regiment, Brave Rifles Week. But that is my time to unwind. I love doing cars, car shows, car meets, car events. I go to the track and race from time to time, and that is something I enjoy doing. I get to drive fast and not get a ticket. And if I break anything, I'm not going to hurt anyone or anything else. So that's what I enjoy doing. That's my safe space, is my garage, turning wrenches and pulling things apart, putting them back together, and making a vehicle to take that machine and make it look like something the original designers never intended for it to look like. No. I love it. And
it's awesome.
Yeah, I love it. It's awesome. And I've got a supportive system. My wife saw how much I liked it. She got into the car scenes. Yeah. And so I get to work on her truck. And then my children started helping me hang parts. And now it's turned into a family affair.
Nice.
But when I do need some time to step away from work, to step away from the family, you know, I love my wife. We don't always see eye to eye. And so when we need a little bit of space and we might not be talking to one another, I can always go to, I call her my second wife in the garage, and she doesn't talk back. So that's the running joke around my family. That's my second wife outside in the garage.
Nice. As we kind of get close to wrapping this up, I want to ask, and this question is for any of you, if there were someone listening now or someone at the recruiter station, what would you all say to encourage them to go fires? And even beyond that, to come to 3CR to do field artillery?
Well, I'll jump on it first. Like I said, what drew me here was staying light, right? Like, 777s have their place instead of Paladins. I myself am a huge 119er fan. You can put them anywhere. Yeah, you have a shorter range. But to go artillery, it drives to exactly what we've been talking about. Like, in any formation, you're going to have the most mass casualty producing weapon. You have some of the best sensors in any of your organizations to be beneficial to your organization for getting ahead of the flaw and sensing and shaping the deep fight. We are limited, right, in shaping that deep fight. But if you want to be the person that understands the maneuver plan and how you're supporting that maneuver plan at a level equal to a higher headquarters, like, fires is right for you. Typically, as a troop fire support officer, you'll be the second in command in a tactical scenario, not one of the PLs a lot of times, because that PL is going to understand their piece of the plan. But as that troop company level fire supporter, you have to understand that whole organization's plan in order to enable it. And you're typically the right-hand person for that commander as they're executing the operations. So it on the officer side, and obviously the NCOs are going to speak on the NCO and enlisted side in general, but on the officer side, it requires a higher level understanding of tactics and how you're able to shape that fight. As far as coming to 3CR specifically is, I don't know if there's a brigade size element in the Army that has a prouder and richer history than 3rd Cavalry Regiment. We're the oldest regiment in the Army, still going strong. And if you want to be a part of a team that really embodies, like, love the one you're with, then at a brigade size element, 3rd Cavalry Regiment is, in my opinion, and only, you know, 14 years and change, it's not beatable. The only thing I could think that might compete would be like the 173rd. But as far as not the 173rd, it is tough to beat 3rd Cavalry Regiment for pride. And you are it on Fort Hood. This is the side of base where the high performers, typically speaking, want to be. And when I say high performers, I mean exactly what Sergeant McCoy alluded to, of physically and mentally fit. We are not stay mounted until you die or death before dismount. You know, we are not death before dismount. We are very much so park the vehicles, get out and go, gain contact with the enemy, and close with and destroy. And that is the 3rd Cavalry mindset. So if that is something you're interested in, this would be, on this installation, the place to come.
Okay. This is the job I love. I couldn't see myself being anything else other than 13 Fox. If you want to join the Army and you want to do the Army stuff like you saw in the videos, like I saw as a child growing up watching the movies, the G.I. Joe and things along, I'm an 80s baby. If you want to do that, 13 Fox is the career field to go to. I have been there, you know, prior to DeVarty with our infantry battalion, lived there with mm-hmm. them every single day. I went to an infantry board when I became a young sergeant. I sat in front of a bunch of infantry first sergeants, and we lived with them day in and day out. When they trained, we trained. When we trained, they came with us and did our fire support training. We cross-trained with one another. I've been with cavalry squadrons, numerous cavalry squadrons, heavy, striker, light. I've done, you know, worked with the fixed wing, Air Force and Navy, rotary wing from the Army and the Marine Corps. And it has been a tremendous experience. I have seen and done and observed the most devastating weapon systems that the United States has to offer, and traveled around the world and got paid well to do it.
Yeah.
So I would encourage anybody, if you're interested in joining the Army, hey, look into 13 Fox. It will not disappoint you. The Army always has its times where you're going to mop floors and pick weeds out of the flower beds and whatnot. However, when it's time to train, we go hard in the paint. And when we relax and we have our downtime, we enjoy each other. The camaraderie is like no other. It's a very small community, fire support community, and we support one another, you know, 110%. As far as 3rd Cavalry Regiment, I'm getting ready to transition to Fort Bliss. They're going to be in a brigade OC of the ACRC over there. However, I will always be a brave rifleman at heart. Now, this organization has a proud tradition, a long history, and I will always take this organization with me wherever I go. I'll be 3CR in some capacity for the rest of my life.
I'll start with the proud to be a 3CR member. As I said, this is my third time here. Both my other times, I was down the road. I spent time in 3rd Brigade and 2nd Brigade. And both times I was there, I had friends down here at 3CR. You know, it's always one of the grass is always greener on the other side kind of situations where I was stuck on a Bradley and didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
And then you talk to your friends down here and like, well, we're doing dismount stuff and nobody really stays in the striker. And I was like, well, I want to do that, you know? So it was always somewhere I wanted to be. So now I'm down here. It's a unique experience because you are mechanized, but it's not as much of the heavy mechanized mentality. It is a lot more of the light mentality. So essentially you're a light unit. fighting on a heavy area battlefield, like a heavy size battlefield. So instead of walking 6 to 10 clicks and your mission's over, you're driving 20, walking 5 to 10, and then your mission's over. And, you know, you got to plan for that whole route along the way and support your maneuver the entire way. So it's a very unique experience in the planning side. I enjoy being down here. I've loved it. It's a very different experience. It's pretty cool. As far as the field artillery, really, field artillery has everything you want to do. If you only want to work on guns and you love big explosions, go be a Bravo, work on the guns. If you love computers and you want to whiz and plan stuff, go be a Juliet and work in an FTC and play with the AFA TADS. If you are into radars and stuff you can't see, go be a radar guy. If you want to do literally everything, like Sergeant McCoy said, then go be a 13 Fox.
Yeah.
And then we get to play with everything. We get to walk with everything. You can work with Bradleys, tanks, strikers. You can walk everywhere, talk to any kind of aircraft the military has. You can do it all.
I do hope that table progression goes well. I hope you guys have some competent people that can pull some lanyards. And I would like to observe that at the very least, just to see that.
Yeah, we'll have you out.
Okay. Well, guys, thanks for coming on. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys in the fight down the road.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thanks for tuning in to Legends Among Us podcast. If you like what you heard, leave some remarks in the comments section of your favorite podcast service. There's information about the podcast on 3CR's Facebook and Instagram pages, including QR codes for all the episodes. Join us again in a few weeks. My next guest that I'll be interviewing is Colonel Todd Hertling, the Brigade Commander for 1st Brigade, 1st Cavalry Division here at Fort Hood. Used to be the squadron commander at Sabre Squadron during the early years of OIF-1. Should be a great interview. Otherwise, have a great week. Aye.